You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Human.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Oh, all things considered, I guess I'm not doing that bad. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Human Majd, a political commentator, journalist, author. You are of Iranian descent. You were born in Tehran. Your father, I believe, was a diplomat under the Shah of Iran. Your grandfather was an Ayatollah and a professor of philosophy at the University of Tehran. You've written a number of books about Iran. The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, back in 2008. More recently, The Ayatollah's Democracy, an Iranian Challenge. And most recently, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. So we're approaching, I guess, the 2-week mark of this war. And I'm hoping to draw on your understanding of the structure of the Iranian state and the composition of the current regime, the ever-changing composition. People seem to keep dying and need to be replaced. To kind of get a sense for where this thing might head, to the extent that that's possible to think about clearly, given all the contingencies. But so here's my understanding of kind of the state of play. Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran. Iran's response, I think they surprised a number of people by how rapidly they decided to distribute the pain regionally to Arab states and so on, oil markets. What you heard at the time was they want to put enough pressure on Trump via Arab states, via the financial markets, to get him to stop, and then they won't be getting attacked. Now, more recently, you've been hearing something a little different, which is that they now understand that getting the Americans and the Israelis to stop doesn't solve the problem, because apparently they're just going to keep attacking Iran every few months, right? They attacked them in June, both unprovoked, like this attack, and said, okay, we're done, we did it. But then they attacked them again 6, 7, 8 months later, whatever it is. So now what you're hearing is, no, even if America stops, Iran may not stop, because they want to inflict pain until, first of all, this is remembered very clearly as regrettable on the part of the U.S., at least, if not Israel. And secondly, they want to get something that makes them feel more enduringly secure. Now, I'm having trouble imagining what that would be. Like, I don't imagine some, you know, overhaul of security structure that is signed on to by America and Israel and everyone. But you tell me, first of all, if I do have this more or less right, like what you would correct about what I said and where in light of all this you think we may be heading.
Well, you know, you're not wrong. I think there's a slight difference. I have a slight difference in opinion, and that is that I believe that not only did the Arab Gulf states in the Persian Gulf and Saudi Arabia know that Iran was going to do this, they actually went to great lengths with the Omani foreign minister flying from Geneva to meet with Vance, because he couldn't meet with President Trump, to explain to him what the Iranians were offering, desperate to avoid this war, mainly because they knew the blowback. They knew this was going to happen. And the reason they knew it, because Iran had been saying it. Iran had been saying this since the June war, which you pointed out 8 months ago, had said, okay, there was restraint on our part. Once Trump announced a ceasefire, unilateral ceasefire, Israel announced a ceasefire, Iran said, okay, you know, we hit the base in Qatar. That was our restraint. That's it. Good. We're going to move on now, get back to talks, which they did. They got back to talks. But they said, next time, no more Mr. Nice Guy. They actually made it very clear, because the circumstances under which this war was started were virtually the same as the last time. In other words, a day or two after Iran sat with American negotiators. Now, mm-hmm. You can argue that those negotiators were probably not qualified to be sitting with Iran to negotiate a nuclear deal. I'm talking about Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. No disrespect to their abilities in other areas, but certainly they are not nuclear scientists. They are not diplomats. They have no experience whatsoever in dealing with Iranians, Iranian culture, any of that. And they were sitting alone in a room without any backup from the State Department, without any experts to explain to them what was going on, except for the Omani foreign minister, who was trying to actually had to fly back. But anyway, the war started a couple of days after that. In June, it was the same thing, a couple of days after negotiations, where Iran believed, in June, they believed that the negotiations were moving forward. They were taken by surprise with the Israeli bombardment and then the American bombardment with the massive ordnance on their nuclear sites. This time around, they were, again, taken by surprise because they did actually think, according to what the Omani foreign minister said, according to what Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, probably nodding their heads when Iran was saying, we're going to give up this and that, we're going to do this and that, that Trump would probably continue in the next few days, next week or so, negotiating an end to what he was calling the nuclear crisis. Mm-hmm. And they were, at this point, it's abundantly clear, it's not me, that everybody, every expert says this, and I'm not an expert, but every expert says this, that what Iran was offering to the United States in this last round was much better deal for the U.S. and the Western world than what Obama had gotten with the JCPOA.
Right.
And so the idea, at least from the Iranians' perspective, is they understood that what Trump really wanted out of this was to have a deal that he could say, look, Obama was an idiot. He doesn't know how to make a deal. I made the best deal. I blew that one up. I made a better deal. Mm-hmm. Not only would his base believe him, but I think most experts say, well, he's right. He's right that the deal is better because it would be, by definition.
Can I just say, if all he had done is restart the clock on the Obama deal, he could have said, you know, Obama's was going to expire in blah, which was 15 years after it was established. I mean, begin to expire kind of phase. Yeah. But mine is like, you know, and name the date 15 years from now. Of course, he could have gotten 20 years. He could have gotten, and as you said, the underlying deal was better.
And
under the Obama deal, there was really intrusive monitoring and inspections. Like, we knew what was going on. And now we don't.
24 hours a day.
That's my editorial comment. Go ahead.
No, and that's an absolutely, you know, that's an absolutely correct comment. But at any rate, so they were this time around, and they had anticipated this could happen. They're not stupid. They saw the ships moving to the middle. They saw the B-2 bombers going to Deogarth. They saw the fighter jets flying from the United States to London, to Jordan. They knew that that was a setup, but they were hoping to avoid that. And once the first day of the war, we saw, obviously, school children were in school. I should point out that Saturdays are the first day of the week in Iran. Fridays are the Muslim Sabbath, so Fridays are the day off. So Saturday is the first day of the, you know, on the Thursday night, they'd had negotiations with Witkoff and Kushner in Geneva. Friday night, late night, middle of the night for us in Tehran, it's Saturday morning. Kids go to school at 7:30 a.m. They're in school. 2 hours later, Tomahawk missile hits the school. At the same time, in Tehran, the Supreme Leader's compound is bombed by Israel. So the war starts. 168 children, I think. I can't remember the exact number. It's up to 175 people killed in that school. Supreme Leader, one of his daughters, a grandkid, plus some, you know, tens of military leaders killed in that initial strike. It's hard to know what exactly the intention was with that strike, other than to, you know, decapitate the regime, and thinking that maybe by that decapitation people would rise up, or that the country would fall apart. It's a misreading of the way the Iranian, if you want to call it a dictatorship or, you know, autocracy, whatever you want to call it, works. It's not a traditional dictatorship. There are very, very, it's, you know, it's got a very deep bench of players. It has the ability, it's been around for almost half a century. It's figured out how to survive so far and has anticipated these kinds of moves, anticipated it with after the Iran-Iraq war, that it could be invaded by another country, which is why it built up its ballistic missiles. Because in Iran, during the Iran-Iraq war, Saddam was firing Scuds into Tehran, and Iran didn't have missiles to fire back. So they've been planning for these kinds of events, even if they thought they were unlikely, for many, many years. But certainly once the war started, I don't think, and you're right about this, that they're going to easily let Donald Trump off the hook, specifically Donald Trump off the hook. I think it appears to be that the strategy is to cause so much pain that they are in a stronger negotiating position when the war does end than if there had never been a war in the first place, where they were being pounded by the U.S. both psychologically and with sanctions. So what they're going to extract, or they want to extract with this pain they're causing, is and causing across the region, as you pointed out, is a better deal than they would have gotten if there hadn't been a war. And part of that is that they're going to need a non-aggression pact of some sort. Whether they're going to trust America to abide by a non-aggression pact or Israel to abide by it is another story. But at least if you have it, on paper, mm-hmm. the argument for aggression from the other side is going to be harder for them to make to their own publics in what we still consider the U.S. to be a democracy. So, and the pain is great. It's much greater than people anticipated because, as a perfect example, Dubai getting hit. Dubai was supposed to be, the Middle East Monaco. It's supposed to be the place where the rich and famous can go and buy property and villas, and they can park their money there, and the American banks are there. And it's, a wide open place for and free and safe. People with families moved there, especially Europeans. Schools for kids, European schools and American schools for kids. And now the question is, how safe is it? How safe is that place going to be for us? And I don't know if that's ever going to come back, that idea of Dubai being so the Emiratis are worried. Emirates Airlines, and Dubai Airport, the most busiest airport in the world, was shut down basically for a week.
And they will accordingly have a stake in securing some kind of long-term security arrangement. The Arab nations will want, as unlikely as it might seem, that you could have a credible non-aggression pact. And by the way, the UN charter was supposed to be a non-aggression pact. But we don't take that seriously anymore. No. Witness this particular war, which plainly violates the charter, which is, by the way, a treaty that our Senate ratified.
Yes.
I can kind of see the logic. I hadn't quite thought of it this way, that when you get down to actually trying to hammer out a security arrangement, maybe complete with a treaty, all the Arab states, as pissed off as they may be at Iran right now, and of course they're equally pissed off at Israel and the U.S., will have just a strong rational interest in nailing something down. Because
absolutely.
If they do not establish that confidence, then Dubai's whole business model is over. Doha will never be what it was. Leave aside the energy markets. And what about these data centers, right? We're going to put these $1 trillion AI data centers in the region if it's not secure? There's OpenAI or whoever was going to run this damn thing is just lucky it wasn't built before this.
Absolutely. It's like a radar base or whatever it was in Jordan that was hit by the Iranians.
That's not what it was.
Yeah.
So do you think that it's true that if Trump and Israel really stopped the fighting, Iran would say, as you're hearing now, sorry, we're not done yet. We don't want to inflict more pain. Or is that, as I've kind of suspected, is that more of a talking point they want to get out there to convey to Trump, look, you'll be lucky to get the functional equivalent of a ceasefire right now because they may not settle for that. That's kind of my guess, is that it's a little more of a talking point than an actual.
Well, it might be. I don't think if unilaterally both Israel and the United States, or bilaterally, announced a ceasefire, we're not hitting you anymore. That's it. We're done. We're in and out. I don't know how exactly Trump's going to justify that, other than he's slowly starting to, in a way, by saying, "Oh, we defeated their navy. They don't have any planes anymore. We got airspace superiority." But a unilateral or bilateral ceasefire. First of all, the question is, would Israel abide? Israel has said they want to assassinate the new supreme leader. They're really pushing for some kind of regime collapse. I don't know that they really want regime change that leads to a democratic country that is then friendly with the U.S. I think they really want superiority over the entire Middle East, and they certainly want to see Iran, huge country with a big population, 93 million, very educated population, as a danger to that hegemony. So it appears that Iran is not going to trust Israel to the extent that it might even be willing to trust the United States. But here's where the Arab states, as you pointed out, come into play, whether it's the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar. All these countries have a vested interest in this not just stopping, pausing, and then for both Israel or the United States to mow the grass, as it were, to keep going and bombing them every time. So that pressure, and these are, you know, Qatar gave an airplane to Donald Trump. I mean, these people know how to work Donald. So, yeah. You know, the Bitcoin, the Donald Bitcoin, I don't know what it's worth, but certainly the Arabs invested in it. So Trump likes them. He likes the Arab Gulf leaders. Yeah. And that pressure is going to be there. So if there's a bilateral ceasefire announced, I agree with you. I don't see Iran firing missiles into Dubai anymore. I don't see that. But they're going to sit back, I mean, and say, okay, what's next? So you tell us what you want to do. Now that you've stopped it, we're going to rebuild our missiles. We're going to rebuild our country. But now we want you to talk to us about lifting sanctions. And this is where the Europeans might come in as well. Say, look, you know, a failed state, Iran does no one, and Turkey does no one any good. Turkey has a border with Iran. Iranians, if they're going to be refugees because there's a failed state or a civil war or there's the Kurdish rebellion, the Azeri rebellion, people will start fleeing across the border into Turkey. And from Turkey, they're going to be trying. Erdogan will make sure they get to Germany somehow. So, you know, there's all these factors, geopolitical factors, that I think Iran is figuring out. And in answer to your original question, I'm not sure that they have actually thought about exactly what they're going to do the day the bombing stops.
Right.
And I think that is, you know, an unknown. A known unknown, as Donald Rumsfeld would say.
Yeah, because, you know, as people have been saying, in a way, for the regime, survival is victory, especially in light of the fact that, as you suggested, Israel would consider it a win if the state just collapsed and chaos reigned and there was a civil war. I think it's clear with the way Israel is behaving on all fronts they've kind of given up on ever being on good terms with anybody. And they figure, look, the world's always going to hate us. We just have to make sure that everyone in our neighborhood is too weak to do anything.
Correct.
If that means we have to go back and keep, quote, mowing the lawn and destroying their weapons, as they've done recently with Syria and with Hezbollah and with Iran, okay. And if it means they collapse and really don't have a state, so much the better. I mean, from Israel's point of view, this is not an exaggeration of Israel's position. I don't know if it's dawned on Trump that probably doesn't make sense for that to be America's position or not. Who knows? But you know, so that's why people say survival is victory for the regime. And you and I have been talking as if survival is assured. We've been saying, well, what will they do in 2 days, in 2 weeks, and so on? And of course, that's not the way people were talking even 6 days ago, right? And I'm wondering, is that an unwarranted degree of confidence that the regime will survive? Or do you think, you know a lot more about this than I do. Do you think that now the regime is kind of like out of the woods and notwithstanding the popular discontent that we saw before the war and notwithstanding all the, you know, the ongoing attacks and the ability of the U.S. and Israel to degrade infrastructure almost at will, notwithstanding all that, does it seem to you like, yeah, we can think of this now in kind of game theoretical terms? There's a regime that's going to be around, and there's the U.S., and there's Israel, and there's these Arab states, and so on.
Right. I mean, I think the confidence that the regime is going to survive is probably well-placed, because it doesn't appear, and there's a caveat there. The caveat is that if the U.S. lands ground troops, as yesterday on Tuesday, a few senators in a briefing said that that's something they had heard as a possibility, then sure, the United States has the capacity. They would have to land 30, 40, 50,000 troops in a country the size of Western Europe. And they could march on Tehran and they could overthrow the regime. So the regime wouldn't survive. But if that's not on the cards, the regime will in all probability survive. And because Donald Trump has not indicated that he cares about democracy in Iran, just by the mere fact that he says, oh, the regime can stay as long as the supreme leader is someone I can choose, I like, then the regime is staying. So that's his particular view, and that's him saying it. The Israelis keep saying, you know, rise up, this is your chance. Netanyahu said that this week. This is your chance to take over. But people are not, I mean, people who are saying that, including all over Twitter and commentators on Fox News or whatever, they're not then saying, well, who is going to take over? Because people can't take over a government, especially when they're under bombardment. There is not a single leader of the opposition who has any real ground operation in Iran that could then replace this regime. If the people rise up and take over, let's say, the state television network and, you know, start saying the revolution is here, okay, well, who's going to take charge? Who is the person who's going to take charge? The Shah's son, nobody in Iran, I shouldn't say nobody, very few people in Iran, especially now, because he has supported this war on Iran and hasn't even once expressed any kind of sadness or condolences for even the school children, the girls who got killed in this war, is rapidly losing any popularity he may have had inside Iran, which is evidence from the Financial Times has a reporter on the ground, wrote a big story about it this week. So,
was that from the beginning, to some extent, just kind of an externally financed thing? And I gather, by the way, that your father's service in the Shah's regime has not led you to jump on the Pahlavi bandwagon yourself. It sounds like it didn't transfer.
No, it didn't. And it didn't transfer from my father, even when he was alive. He did not consider Pahlavi a serious at all. And in fact, rightly so. My dad died before this, even before the Mahsa Amini protest, which is when the Pahlavi, after 40 some years of basically not doing very much, and raising a family and living a life with the millions of dollars that he inherited in Maryland and suburban Washington, Virginia and Maryland and Paris, my father then didn't think he was serious and wouldn't have backed him because he didn't think he was serious. And that's not just my father. I know a lot of people of my father's generation who served. My father was our ambassador, Iran's ambassador to Japan, very close to Ardeshir Zahedi, who was the ambassador in Washington at the time before the revolution. And Ardeshir Zahedi never put his money on on Reza Pahlavi. So he has not been considered serious by most serious people. That's the way I'll put it. Even people who were very close. And Ardeshir Zahedi, I should point out, was very close to the Shah. He was his son-in-law. He gave the Shah his first grandchild. Through the marriage to his daughter. When he divorced the Shah's daughter, he remained close friends with the Shah. He was the ambassador.
This is who, I'm sorry I missed that we're talking about now? This is
Ardeshir Zahedi, who was the U.S. Iranian ambassador to the U.S. at the time of the revolution.
Did not support Pahlavi.
He's also passed away last year, but he did not support Pahlavi either. So, yeah, there's Pahlavi. And then there's the MEK. We should talk about them, too. The MEK.
Yeah, this religious group that has paid a number of people like Rudy Giuliani lots of money to say nice things about them. They used to be designated an American terrorist group, and then they got themselves delisted. But anyway, yeah, they don't have a lot of... So there's nobody in Iran that has a lot of internal support. By the way, I forgot to mention... you, as long as we're talking about your distinguished lineage and your own distinguished biography, you served as translator for two, I think, Iranian presidents when they were in the U.S. You weren't on the staff, but when they were in the U.S., both Khatami and Ahmadinejad used you as their translator, right?
Yeah, not specifically translator. It's a long story. I don't want to get into here necessarily, but it was very, very quickly. Khatami, through marriage, is a relation of mine. And he, when he was coming to America after his presidency to do a tour around colleges, asked me if I would accompany him. They didn't have an interpreter. But they had written all his speeches in English. They had translated all his speeches into English. And so I sat next to him and read his as I was listening to him speaking Farsi. Then the Ahmadinejad people who saw this in Iran, saw some of the coverage of Khatami. He said, oh, we want that guy to read my speech at the UN. Okay. So I agreed to do it. When they asked me if I would do it, I said, only if I could write about it, only if it could be an article. And they said, yeah, we don't care. So then it became, it was the cover story for the New York Observer, which back then was a newspaper.
Owned by
not
Jared
then.
Kushner. Oh, not
it,
then?
Not then. Okay. Back then it was not by, you know, back then it was actually independently owned by someone who was Peter Kaplan, I believe. Anyway, it was a New York institution, and it was a cover story. So that's very briefly.
So
but yes, I do have connections with the regime. I don't deny it, with people who have been in the regime, not so much with the hardliners, but definitely with the Khatami folk, the foreign minister under Rouhani, connections through Khatami to Rouhani and his, when I say connections, not familial, but just, you know, being able to have them as sources in my writings, talk about them in my books and my articles. Yes.
And I hadn't actually planned to ask you this, but do you think there was an opportunity? I mean, the regime seems to have, I guess you would say, on balance, you know, it's gone through ups and downs in terms of degree of seeming openness to, you know, diplomatic contact and even potentially, and this is kind of my question, you know, integration into the, the global and Western economy. And it has seemed to me that, like, say, as of the Obama deal, a nuclear deal, which I think was actually quite a triumph given the domestic American political opposition to it, seemed to me that at that point, I mean, Iran had a kind of moderate president, and the president at least then wasn't nothing. I mean, you know, he's truly democratically elected. He had some degree of actual significance and influence. And it seemed to me there might have been a chance at that point, especially if we'd really followed through robustly on sanctions relief and stuff, to actually draw Iran into you know, ongoing, mutually beneficial economic engagement with many countries and so on, and as a result, be in a totally different place right now. Do you think, but I recognize there is a true ideology behind, you know, the regime, a revolutionary kind of ideology and so on. So maybe that couldn't happen. I don't know. What is your take on what was in principle possible at various times over the last 30 years?
Well, over the last 30 years, there have been, you know, both sides have lost opportunities that were available to them. So I think we can fault both Iran and the United States to not, you know, grab an opportunity. Clinton was kind of, Bill Clinton was kind of open to relations with Iran, right when Khatami, who was the first true reformist president, was elected in Iran in 1997. And there was an opportunity there to, you know, at least have a handshake between Khatami and President Clinton at the UN. Clinton was trying to get that to happen. Khatami was afraid, was checking with folks back home and said, not a good idea at this point. Let's see how it goes. But there was a certain amount of openness. And with Khatami, there was a lot of hope inside Iran. And there was openness inside Iran. The hijab started becoming less and less severe. When I say in its use, hair started showing, women's hair started showing. There was a lot more freedom. Cafes started opening. Men and women started hanging out in cafes that you're not supposed to under the so-called Sharia law on unmarried couples. So you saw this opening, and it was quite popular. I mean, Khatami was very popular for a while. There were a couple of protests that were put down, not by him, and he was against that. But so there was that opening. And then George Bush comes along, it's 9/11, Iran had candlelight vigil in Tehran for 9/11, the only one in the Middle East. Iran sent its regrets, Khatami was president. And within, you know, 6 months or whatever it was, we had the Axis of Evil, Iran being included in the Axis of Evil. Then the Iraq War, and then Iran looked at the Iraq War as danger to them because he had that famous saying, real men go to Tehran. You know, the Dick Cheney idea.
And they were on the list. They were on some lists of some people in the administration.
Absolutely. They were on the list of the Cheneys.
And we had
world.
Supported Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s, which was maybe the most traumatic experience in a way in Iranian, in revolutionary Iran's history, right? That war, I mean, the war.
The war absolutely. So there was a lot of distrust and mistrust of the United States. Right after the invasion of Iraq, Iran offered through somebody I happen to know who confirmed it to me, offered a letter to the United States. It was passed on by the Swiss ambassador who represents U.S. interests in Iran, who vouched for the authenticity. And then I also can vouch for the, because I know the person who authored it, who was close with the Supreme Leader, which mm-hmm. was basically, look, let's sit down and talk, because Iran was a little worried that the Iraq invasion was going to be successful, which it was in terms of getting rid of Saddam, and then they just move on to Iran. Let's talk about the nuclear issue. Let's talk about our support for Hezbollah and various other groups, and we can sit down and figure all this out. Everything is on the table. The U.S. Condi Rice rejected it, the letter, out of hand. And the U.S. actually chastised the Swiss ambassador for even presenting it. One of the reasons they rejected it was because it wasn't on letterhead. Because it was on...
Well, wait, that was the stated view. That can't be the real reason they rejected it, right?
That's why. They didn't think it was authentic. And they said to the Swiss ambassador, this is according to the reports that I read at the time, and other people have confirmed whether it's 100% true or not, because we haven't spoken to Condi Rice about it, or I haven't spoken to her, is that they didn't think the letter was authentic. And they were high. I mean, I guess Iran's problem
seems like in principle there would be a way to find out.
You would think. But it appears, according to some people I spoke to, the Iranians interpret that as they were high. It was the early days of the Iraq War, mission accomplished days. Uh-huh. Okay. And they were high on that victory, and they didn't really want to entertain, even if they right. sort of knew that this was real or potentially real. They didn't right. want to entertain. So that's another yeah. instance. But when going back to the JCPOA and Obama, you know, Obama, when he took office in 2008, said, you know, if you extend a hand, I'll take your hand to the Iranian people, to the Iranian government, to the regime. Stop saying, you know, the regime is evil. Stop saying, you know, we've got to do. And, you know, it took a while because Ahmadinejad was still president then. But in his second term, the opportunity was there with the election of Rouhani, a very popularly elected person, moderate in Iran, supported by Khatami, supported by the reformists who had been, you know, shut out of politics for during the Ahmadinejad years, and authorized John Kerry, the supreme leader, and the president Rouhani authorized Iran's foreign ministers, Javad Zarif, to open communication with John Kerry, direct communication with the United States. And as we know, 2 years later, they signed a nuclear deal. I mean, you saw images of foreign minister of Iran walking, you know, by the lake in Geneva in discussion with John Kerry. We had never seen that. I should point out that had never happened in the history of the United States right. and Iran since the revolution. Never. So it was direct communication. It was a successful communication. What the Supreme Leader said at the time, he said, I don't trust the Americans. I'm going to let you make this deal, but I don't trust them, and you shouldn't trust them, and we'll see how it goes. So unfortunately, he turned out to be right, because not only did, forgetting about the fact that Donald Trump tore up the deal, which was proof that the American side, for the mm-hmm. Iranians anyway, mm-hmm. couldn't be trusted, but Barack Obama, probably for political reasons, moved very slowly on the sanctions relief. Mm-hmm. The day that mm-hmm. Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, arrived back in Tehran at Mehrabad Airport from signing the JCPOA, there were huge crowds of young people, almost like, you know, he's a rock star arriving, because they were so happy that life was going to be better. Things are getting much better. Things are moving forward. We're going to be integrated, as you pointed out, Bob, that, you know, there was this chance for the mm-hmm. Iranian people to be integrated into the world economy. You know, for a perfect example is Boeing sent their Middle East top executive, I think he's based in Dubai, to Tehran to negotiate. I mean, here you have Boeing going to Tehran, negotiate a deal for airplanes. It mm-hmm. never went through. Iran signed a deal to buy all these Boeing aircraft, which would have provided jobs for Americans. And the deal never went through because, well, the deal went through, but it was never executed because Obama wouldn't give the license. for Boeing to sell.
So you think Obama was under political pressure from the same people who had opposed the deal to begin with, which was to no small extent the Israel lobby, broadly construed, right?
And the hawks in America who just don't like Iran for whatever reason, whether it's because of Israel or just don't like Iran because of death in America, whatever, you know, whatever the reason is.
Right. And it's for it's funny the way these things spiral, because within the military, the American military, you know, which often you can rely on military officers for a relatively cold-blooded and detached perspective on things when you can't get that from politicians who are playing from the crowd. But because our presence in Iraq was so threatening to Iran, and so Iran did do whatever it could to support militia, anti-American militias within Iraq, there are a lot of people in the American military who came to see Iran as the enemy. For that reason.
For that reason, absolutely.
And that matters. Yeah. And that matters when people are like recommending strikes on Soleimani to Trump. And he's like, yeah, what the fuck? Let's push the button.
Let's push the button. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, you know, would things have been different if there were 80 Iran Air Boeing jets and American trained mechanics and parts and even American actual engineers based in Tehran to help with these jets? Would it have changed things? Probably. I mean, the Iranians at that point, the supreme leader at that point, had reluctantly, to be fair, said, yeah, let's see what we can do. Renault did I can't remember how many billion-dollar investment in Iran, the French car company. Apparently, at that time, there were, I think, something like, you know, I don't know how many luxury hotels in Tehran. You could not get a room at a luxury hotel in Tehran because all these Western executives were flying to Tehran to see what kind of business could be done. And some business was done. Airbus did actually sell some planes to Iran and would have sold a lot more. But again, the hesitation on Obama's part, is not that I'm blaming him because I understand the political, and he didn't, and he certainly wanted the next president to be a Democrat, obviously, you know, someone, an elder of the Democratic Party at that point. And then, of course, Donald Trump became president to the great surprise of many. And when he became president, he threatened to withdraw from the deal right away from the very beginning. And he was advised not to because the deal was working. Everybody in the U.S. government said to him, well, it's working. Iran's not building a nuclear, has incapable of building a nuclear weapon. Their stockpile is tiny of enriched uranium. Every time it grows, they ship it out to Russia, and then Russia sends them fuel rods back for their reactor. So something that's working, no, we got to tear it up. We got to tear it up. And then, as you point out, from then on, it was, let's kill Qasem Soleimani. So there was never any real chance, unfortunately, because of these events over the last 30, 40 years, for there to be that détente or entente, if you want to call it, between the U.S. And Iran. And I think every step of the way along this path of 47 years, Israel has been basically, the elephant in the room. It's like, what about Israel? And because Netanyahu since 1996, during Clinton's term, was saying that Iran is like a year away from building a nuclear weapon and putting that out there. And a constant message, Iran is way. And at that point, they didn't even know if Iran had a nuclear program at all. It was 2003. Mm-hmm. But he was putting the message out that Iran is a year away from a nuclear weapon. Iran is a year away. Then it got shorter. Iran is a month away, 2 months away from a nuclear weapon. And that, I mean, we have to be fair. That affects American politics. It just simply does. What Israel says about countries in the region, in its region, in the Middle East, affects American politics. Mm-hmm. Whether we like it or not, it does.
Okay. So I want to get back to future prospects where this war may be heading. But we've gotten to the point where we go into what we call overtime. That's accessible to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I encourage everyone to become. Before we do that, is there a place people can go to find your stuff, Houman? I mean, I know you're on Twitter. I see you on Twitter.
Yes.
What's your Twitter handle? Is it just, straightforward? Houman.
I think it's H and then my last name, Maj, M-A-J-D, H-Maj.
Okay.
H-Maj. That's it. I mean, you know, I have, I have articles. I mean, I did a thing for Time. I did a thing for Intercept. I do podcasts every now and then. And then I'm an NBC News contributor. So I actually end up being on NBC News. I used to also be on MSNBC, but in the split between NBC and MSNBC, the deal that was made was that neither side would appear on the other network. So even though I'm not an employee, being a contributor, I don't appear. I'm not allowed to appear on MS Now, the new company.
I see.
So it's a strange. So I do appear on NBC News from time to time. Generally speaking, if I have an article, I'll post it on Twitter. That's the easiest place to find any new article that I post will be on Twitter. I do have a new book out. It's a memoir, so there's a big section on it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't say at the beginning. It's called Minister Without Portfolio, Memoir of a Reluctant Exile.
Okay.
And that speaking of the past history, my father's history, and all that, there's quite a bit of that in there.
That should have been a lead. Okay, we'll link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
I hope people follow us into overtime. But even if you don't, thanks for watching this far, listening this far, you can, spend the time while you're not listening to us in overtime rating and reviewing us, for example, or buying Houman's book. What's the name again? Wait a second. Minister Without
Portfolio. Minister Without Portfolio. Yeah.
Okay. You can do that. One or the other. We'll settle for either. All right. So here we go into overtime.